I forgot to tell Larry Rasmussen, he's always introduced me as Dean and Professor at the College of Veterinary Medicine at Washington State University. That was up to September 1. The reason I wear a smile on my face, I'm no longer running a meat grinder from the inside. I have not retired, but I have stepped down as dean after 10 years. But you can always tell a dean by looking at his silhouette, like here. This is a self-portrait. You can see that they're stooped over for all the times they've gone, "I don't know." And they have sloping foreheads for all the times they've hit themselves on the head and said, "Why didn't I think of that before?" Okay? So that's the reason for that. I've been very interested to hear about Mount St. Helens. I was in charge of evaluating the effects on animals and people at Washington State University. It was one of the worst months of my life. But it did prove to me that God is a Norwegian. Because if you'll remember, it happened on May 18th. It waited to, the biggest celebration in the world is May 17th. And if you don't believe me, you go to Norway on May 17th. It's Suttenmai. And I'll tell you, there's no celebration like May 17th in Norway. And a lot of people in this country also celebrate it. Well, you see, God didn't have the explosion on Mount St. Helens on May 17th. He waited till the 18th. And that's how I know it. This is Mount St. Helens going off. And that's Chinese there, and it says, it's a curse. It says, "May you live in interesting times." And I remind you, it's a curse, and we do. Now, to get down to serious things, I have spent most of my life in the laboratory studying animals, hopefully for the benefit of people and animals. And some of the work that we've done and my associates have done is what I'm going to talk about now. I've already given you something about my pigs, so I won't say much about how great pigs are until tomorrow at 10:45. And then I give another pig thing. It is going to be quite similar to the one you last week, so if you heard the one last week, unless you like punishment, you should stay away. Our research department is rated among the finest and most well-equipped. The motto of our brilliant research staff is, if we can find it, it must be there. So I think that's a good motto. This is kind of an interesting one. Two of my associates came up with a discovery. They think it, if injected in an animal, it would bring about immortality. But I'm telling them, I just heard them say that, and I'm saying to them, but we don't want to test it because it'll take forever to test it. But here is some of our problem today. Somebody's over here doing something and somebody else gets it in the face. And that's what happens when we have a lot of people. Somebody's always catching it somewhere. Now, there are many times I, as an animal man, have kind of wished that I had gone into plants like I almost did. I almost went into plant and soils. This fellow was an associate of mine, quite a distinguished scientist at the University of California. His name is Paul Stumpf. And you see this basket of coconuts, or whatever they are. He did all kinds of experiments on that basket full of coconuts, and he produced 21 papers out of it, he told me. Huh? And he didn't keep them up at night, or he didn't have to worry about what them. Or this associate at my laboratory, she'd go down and buy some spinach from Safeway and do all kinds of studies on this spinach. She'd chop it up, and she didn't get called out at night either. But I decided it was more interesting to work on animals. And here you see, and I don't expect you to read all this, but that isn't a very long list of animals. And really, there are a lot more animals that we could probably work on that would give us a lot of the answers we seek. Because, like one of the great Danish physiologists said, August Krogh said, if there is a special biological problem, if there's a difficult biological problem, if you search long enough, there's probably a special animal that will answer your problem. And this is true. Our problem is our vision up till this time. We have used very few animals to study. Usually they were picked on for sake of convenience. It's something that was easy to take care of, or they didn't eat very much and they were cheap to keep. And this is not always the best criteria. And we speak of animal models of human disease. And up till, when I was sort of in mid-career, I drew this picture of myself because this is how man was defined in comparative medicine. And that's how I've spent my life, is in comparative medicine. And man was defined as something having the brain of a cat, the muscles of a frog, the heart of a dog, the intestines and behavior of a rat, and the genes of a fruit fly. That's how you define man, huh? Because that's the work they did to show what man was about. And I think we can do better than that. A lot of people would like us not to work on animals, but to have something that you fabricate in the laboratory from which you can do all your testing. Unfortunately, we're not there yet. See, there's somebody inside with a computer and everything's working out right, except there isn't probably very many people that'll believe your results. We aren't to the stage yet where you can sort of take one with stripes this way and one with stripes that way and end up with something you can play tit-tat-toe on, like these zebras. But we are getting closer in genetic engineering. There are some fantastic things that are happening when you can cross a French bean with a sunflower and come out with something that we'll probably call a sunbean. You're really doing something. So there are very remarkable things happening. We aren't quite to this yet because that's pretty complicated. But to select the right animal is very critical, and that you ask the right questions of the animal. Today in Europe, there are many children who probably still cry themselves to sleep because even when they're big now, because they have no functional arms, because their mother was given thalidomide when she was pregnant with them. And so they were born without functional arms. Now, they did test some of these drugs, but they didn't test them right and probably didn't select the right animals. This is a study in the primate laboratory at the University of California by some associates of mine. And they gave thalidomide to a mother rhesus monkey from 25 to 30 days of pregnancy and ended up with this poor little fellow here. You see, he has no functional arms. Do you see that? So because they didn't ask the right questions of the right animals, many people suffer today because of that oversight. So it can be very costly. Now, this is a brown bat. If you're a very busy research worker, you can get a small mammal like this. They only weigh about 30 grams, and they don't eat much. And if you put them in the refrigerator, they go into hibernation. So you see, if you're a busy scientist, you can get a cigar box, and you can work on the animal, study its... they're used a lot in studying small capillaries and how they function. And then when you have to go on a trip, you just put them in the cigar box with a little water in the refrigerator, and then you can be gone for a week, and then you can come back, take them out of the refrigerator, and he'll warm up and be all normal again. So if you're a busy scientist, you might consider a brown bat. But you got to ask the right questions. Now, chickens have proven helped us with a lot of things. They had a muscular dystrophy that was very useful in study. They have some anatomy that's very interesting. For example, a lot of our studies on the effect of centrifugation, that is of high G forces. See, before we sent people up in space and working on a lot of this, we wanted to find out what the effect is on a biped, on somebody that stands on 2 feet, like a chicken. So a lot of the studies were done on chickens in a centrifuge at high speeds to see the effect of this. They were also the first viral leukemia, the first leukemia caused by a virus, was described in a chicken. And it's also the first animal in which we have a vaccine to prevent a leukemia-type disease, Merrick's disease. Now, sometimes you pick a very unusual animal, like a wildebeest. And one of the reasons they're studying the wildebeest is that it has an unusual blood circulation in the heart. It has a most remarkable blood circulation. And I don't know, have you ever seen a wildebeest with a heart attack? Well, you've probably never seen a wildebeest, but nobody has probably seen a heart attack in a wildebeest because of its remarkable circulation. So some people study those. This is an armadillo. It's kind of like a miniature Sherman tank. Its IQ is below detection. It doesn't bite or kick. It seems to eat almost anything. It can swim because it takes a whole belly full of air and then floats. It's a very remarkable animal. It's a nine-banded armadillo. And why it became so interesting is that it would give birth to, I think, maybe up to four or so, and it's litters, but the they were immunologically acceptance of one another. That is, if you had four offspring from these, you could transfer the tissue from one to another. They were like identical twins. So they were very interesting to study immunologically. But also very important, up till just recently, they were the only thing that would grow the leprosy bacteria in. It was the only one they could produce it in. So it was very interesting. In fact, a very renowned scientist named Kurt Benersky, who's a dear friend of mine, he's in charge of research for the San Diego Zoological Gardens. He was also head of pathology at the medical school at San Diego. You probably don't recognize his name, but you recognize his son's name, Ralph Benersky, who kicks field goals for the San Diego Chargers, and who does a great work because he has a very serious disease of his, he almost lost his life. He has a serious disease of his intestines. I don't know if he's got very much of his colon left, but he goes into hospitals and to buck up people with the same disease to tell them there's hope for them. They can grow up and be kick field goals too, I guess, is what he tells them. I don't know. Now, sometimes you pick an unusual animal like we did for a while with this one. We were hoping to make a laboratory animal out of this Marmosa mitis. There are about 48 species of these in South and Central America. They're a pouchless marsupial, and the little offspring are born 13 days after they're a gleam in their father's eye. And you see the offspring there, they crawl out sort of and fasten onto a circle of nipples. And if they hang on for 21 days, if they can hang on, then they can start coming off. But if they fall off before 21 days, they're lost. But you see, they're born then very early in embryonic life, so they're very interesting to study. And one of the reasons we were studying them, hopefully, is because of their karyotype, their chromosome pattern. They only had seven chromosomes, see them? And they're very large, and you can tell sort of one from another. And here, it also shows very graphically why women are superior to men. Because you see the XY up here, that determines, that's a male there. You see here, this is a male, and this is a female. You see, they have a lot more DNA, the women do. So that's my story. And I don't think any of the women will disagree. This fellow studies marmosets. They're very small prosimian, you can call them little monkeys. They were very useful early on when we were studying various leukemias. And they were used to good effect also in some immunological studies. This is Jengozian at Oak Ridge, Tennessee. Some people said you ought to work on tigers, you know. They'd be very exciting. You'd make Time magazine and Life and all that kind of things. Because it turns out that feline leukemia, the leukemias in cats, one of my associates in our, when I was directing the comparative oncology laboratory, the cancer laboratory at the University of California, discovered the virus that causes feline sarcoma. Others of my associates discovered two of viruses that cause leukemia in monkeys, or fibrosarcoma and leukemia. I've already mentioned the beauty of pigs, and I'll talk more about those tomorrow, so you'll have to wait on those and join the crusade for miniature swine. I'll get to that. But one of my big interests is not to produce these models, but to take them out of natural life. And these are animals that were the same age that came to my attention at the University of California. They're the same age, they're both German shepherds, but you see the one on the left is a dwarf, probably pituitary dwarfism, and its thyroid wasn't functional either. As a result of that. So you can learn a lot about people by studying and doing some studies on those that would be difficult with people. So we have been on the search for natural models of human disease. And when I came to the Washington State University 10 years ago, there was already an ongoing program on looking at animal models of human disease. And I had been following that work and encouraging it. And I'm going to tell you more about that now. It's probably one of the largest programs in the United States on animal models of human disease. So we'll review some of those with you. One of the early ones they found is a disease that you probably don't know anything about because there aren't very many cases of it, but it's an interesting disease called Chidiak-Higashi. It was discovered originally in the Orient, and it affects it was first discovered, the animal model was first discovered in mink at Washington State University. And one of the characteristics is that they're sort of albino, like this one is. And that was very interesting to my associates. And they discovered that it was like some of the children that are at the clinical center at the National Institutes of Health. And one of the things that happens to them is the granules in some of their cells are affected in this disease, and they don't live a long time. Their immunity is not what it should be, and they have some troubles with their blood, like blood clotting. Well, my associates did a lot of studies on these, and one day one of my associates was playing in bridge with some people from animal science, and they were describing that they had a shorthorn that was an albino. So he couldn't wait to leave the bridge game and run out there and look at it and check its blood and found out it was a Chidiak-Higashi. And you see, it's nice to have an animal model that's this big because if you're trying to get a quart of blood out of a mouse, forget it, you know. But you can get a quart of blood out of one of these and they just go to the next bin of feed. So that's a cow, it's Chidiak-Higashi. And one of my other associates was up in the Vancouver Zoo one day and saw a white whale and checked it out, and sure enough, this had Chidiak-Higashi. Some of my other associates found Chidiak-Higashi in some cats. So it's kind of to show you the universality of many of these things, that we're not the only ones that have a lot of these diseases, or it isn't often restricted to just one species. And it helps to have a multiple species approach to many of these problems. And here is a picture of an albino-like eye from one of the Chidiak-Higashi children at the National Institutes of Health at the Clinical Center, and one from one of our mink. And I bring this out because in our studies we showed that there are real blood clotting problems with Chidiak-Higashi. And at the NIH up to this time, when their children were sick for various reasons, they would give the Chidiak-Higashi children aspirin. Well, our study showed that was the wrong thing to do. And so they quit using it at NIH. So you see, that's just one little incident of the application of this kind of work. Here is a muscular dystrophy. That's a very serious disease in people, and it's of various types. We have discovered, we have seen it here in a mink. You can see the occipital muscle up above and how it's degenerated down below, and you can take sections of this and see that it might be type 1 or type 2 type muscular dystrophy. We now have it we found a model for this in white Labradors. It's really sad to see this, and of course our intention is to define it and hopefully kind of control it. One of our interests, of course, in this, and I mentioned in my Vesper service, genetic counseling. You see, we have that option in our business, and I believe in preventing disease. And these are most of the diseases we're talking about here are genetic problems. This is another one study that we've done in cooperation with some other people, and that's epilepsy. A very serious problem today. I suppose it affects 4 or 5%. Beagle dogs have this disease in quite large numbers. In fact, it's one of the big killers in beagle dogs. And this is just recovered from a seizure. And so we're interested in studying that. Here's another disease called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. You probably haven't seen too many of these unless you went to the circus and saw the Indian rubber man, how you could pull out its skin. Their skin is very fragile. This is a Springer Spaniel like your daughter's, Omar. If Omar is here, his daughter's got a Springer Spaniel. And you see its skin there. You just knock against something and it's very fragile and see all the scars on it, and you can pull the skin way out. We also discovered this in a mink. See how you're holding one by the nap by the top of the head here, sort of? You see that one? It just stretches out. It's a strange thing that happens. So we use these to try to define the problem. Here's one with a cat. Just rubs up against something and it's very fragile. And you see, the reason I'm so interested in this is because if we can help, both people and animals, if we can define this and do something about it. This is a very disturbing thing. It's a Lucian disease in mink. And my associates have done quite a bit of work on this. There's something that we've discovered recently, fairly recently, called slow virus. It doesn't act like regular viruses. And I'm going to spend a few minutes now on this. And they discovered that this is probably a slow virus. Another associate of mine, while he was at University of Wisconsin, he worked on an encephalopathy, a problem with the central nervous system in mink. And it too was a slow virus. This affected the coat color. And you see, they were breeding these mink for a certain platinum kind of coating. And it turns out that this was also related to Illusion mink disease, which may well be a slow virus or a model for it. Well, we have a disease in sheep called scrapie. The reason they call it scrapie is it's a central nervous system kind of disease, and they get itchy, and they rub up against everything. They think they're itching in a way. So they were doing studies on this, and the normal way when you have a disease in animals that's a virus, if you can't isolate it right away, you might take tissue from the animal and then you put it in formalin and then you modify it somewhat and inject it into the animal as a vaccine, because formalin is supposed to kill all viruses. Except at the Compton, at the big station in England, that's what they did. They were going to control scrapie and sheep, so they took these scrapie sheep, they got the tissue from them, they formalized it and then injected it as a vaccine against scrapie and all these sheep. But all it did was spread it around, because the formalin didn't kill this slow virus. Now, a friend of mine named Bill Hadlow, who's also on our guest faculty, who's worked at the Rocky Mountain Laboratory in Hamilton, Montana for many, many years. He's a veterinarian and a neuropathologist. And he was visiting Compton in England, and he was studying scrapie, and he was also studying other slow viruses that were similar in nature in people. Like Jakob Creutzfeldt disease, which may be what affected our former president of ALC, Knudsen. Remember, he died from a very strange disease. It looked like Jakob Creutzfeldt, which may be a slow virus. Also, there's a disease that you've heard a lot about maybe in recent times called Kuru in New Guinea. It's a very disturbing disease. Well, what happened was that Bill Hadlow wrote this letter to Lancet magazine while attempts to draw too close an analogy between diseases of man and lower animals are attended by numerous pitfalls, many valuable clues contributing to the understanding of the fundamental nature of a disease may be gained from a broad comparative viewpoint. And what he suggested was that this scrapion in sheep was very similar to that of Kuru that occurred in the New Guinea tribes. And he was right. In fact, that's how Gajusek and his associates at NIH built the case. Gajusek was down studying these New Guinea people. And you see, one of their customs was that when somebody dies, they'd partake of some of their parts, which sounds kind of awful right after supper, but like brain and liver. And that's how they were able to pass around this terrible disease of Kuru. And it takes a long time to produce these symptoms. But you see, this little child here is afflicted with Kuru. And it's a central nervous system, and it's kind of a slow death. And they have now discovered that it is a virus. They have injected material into a chimpanzee and produced the disease. And for this work, Gajusek got the Nobel Prize. But you see, and I point this out to you because most Nobel Prizes are given to people who have built on the shoulders of others, you see. It isn't usually a single magnificent achievement, but it's the work of many other people. For example, the Iowan who discovered, you know, the short barley and all, or the wheat and all, the dwarf barley, or wheat rather it was, in high producing wheat for the Green Revolution. Well, much of his work was built on the work of a very good friend of mine at Washington State. And this fellow who got the Nobel Prize was one of the first ones to admit it. My only recommendation on Nobel Prizes is I'd hope that they would not give a Nobel Prize to anybody under 80 or 70 when they start losing their voice so they can't speak authoritatively on a lot of subjects that they know nothing about. And it's ruined a lot of good young men. Another disease that two of my associates have become world famous on is combined immunodeficiency. Now, many of you have seen the bubble baby on television, this child that can't live outside of a plastic bubble. Some of you remember that? Because his immune system, he's incompetent. And we have a model for that in Arab foals that was discovered by some of my associates. And Lance Perriman and his associates in our school are world authorities now on combined immunodeficiency and other immune deficiencies of disease. They've been all over much of the world counseling on this and have done some really unusually good work in this field. Another problem, and this is a fairly recent discovery of an animal model for juvenile diabetes. This is a real disturbing disease, and these Kizans, this one on the left, they're litter mates, but this one on the left has juvenile diabetes. And it's one of the first models. Now there's also a model in a non-human primate for juvenile diabetes. So that will help us, hopefully, to do something about this disease. Early on, and also recently, we were concerned with leukemia in cattle. One of the concerns, of course, was can you get leukemia from them if you drink their milk? Well, the chances are no. But eventually they discovered a virus in this. And some of this work, we did some of this work, and then we extended it, and some of my associates discovered a virus, fibrosarcoma virus in cats. And here's a cat so afflicted. And one of my associates who worked on this and took his PhD with us, then went to Harvard after he stopped by Sweden. at Karolinska. I could have had some suggestions on that. No, but I really did encourage him, because the Karolinska Institute is an outstanding research organization. And he has now a chair. He's a veterinarian, has a chair at Harvard School of Public Health. And some of you, I'm sure it made the rounds here, because I saw that when I was in Perth, Australia, about Max Essex, only they call him Myron Essex, and then his associate at the NIH. They feel that AIDS, a very popular disease now, AIDS, the immune deficient disease that affects quite a few people, and is a very perplexing disease, caused a lot of deaths. He feels that because of this background, you see, he has worked a lot with the leukemia virus and the virus with our monkeys, the monkey viruses we found and others. And he they seem to see an association between a leukemia virus and AIDS. So that's kind of an interesting finding, but it shows you how the interrelationship of these things occur. I have to see how my time is here. Yes, we're still all right. One of our works, we discovered a virus in the gibbon. This is a white-handed gibbon, Hylobates lair. They're a very interesting animal. This fellow's name is Judas. I named him Judas because he's a pet. We got him from the San Francisco Zoo because he had injured himself and had a scar on him. And of course, you can't have a scarred animal in a zoo because you get 1,000 calls a day about what's wrong with him. And so we took him up to Davis, and we had a pair of gibbons in another pen. And we needed blood samples from them periodically, but they always knew you were coming in for blood, if you were coming in for blood, even though you might have your syringes hidden. You can't convince them that letting us have a little blood is a good thing. Well, what we used old Judas for is we'd lead him by the pen, and they'd get excited and reach out to grab Judas, and then we'd grab them. So that's why I call him Judas. One day he get out and he started playing with the goats. He's a really interesting guy. That's a trouble with non-human primates. You sometimes wonder who belongs inside the pen and who belongs outside the pen. And wondering what they're thinking. I probably got this upside down, but it's a book there. It says Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire by Gibbon. I thought that was a good thing to do. And here's a couple of my associates who discovered this virus, which caused a lot of excitement throughout the world. A lot of people think this is the only animal you ought to work on because it's the only thing that you can convey and extrapolate to people. It says you look just like your father. But that isn't true. There are some studies that you can do on other animals, and it's no use doing it on a non-human primate when you can do it on less sentient animals and also for a lot less cost. But there are some studies that need to be done on them. And I point out here, a lot of people say, well, you should never work on primates. I'd like to point out a couple of examples of the necessity of research. When I was growing up, and when, like many of you, there were a lot of places you couldn't go to swim because you were afraid of polio. And several of my associates died from polio. I mean, my early friends in when I was young. Some of them were paralyzed in parts of their body. And it was really sad affairs to see these people. And several of them, of course, were in iron lungs. Now, you and I could have gone on and built bigger and bigger iron lungs. And we could have. But somebody, a lot of people, decided that it would be better to prevent it. So a great deal of basic research was invested into developing a vaccine. I suppose we spent, as a government, a few $100 million on developing a vaccine. And we used quite a few non-human primates for this because we needed tissues from non-human primates to grow the virus on. But develop a vaccine we did. Now, there's two things I want to say about that. As a result of this vaccine, we are probably saving about $3 billion a year because we don't have polio now to an extent. But even more important than the $3 billion a year that we save is the untold suffering and the crippling effect of this disease. Now, in analyzing the information and the experiments that went into this, you will find that probably up to half of the studies were of a basic nature where the person that was doing the work had no idea that, you know, that this his basic premise or his objective was the development of a vaccine for polio. But that's the nature of much of research. Sometimes it seems like a great big output like an elephant output for a mouse input. And I know sometimes the taxpayers feel that way. Or I guess like Moses felt when he had to put to work the Ten Commandments, what about the funding? And that does present a problem. Now, there are some interesting developments, and one of the things we're very interested in the area of genetic engineering, and my associates are on the cutting edge in monoclonal antibody research, trying to get the profile of, say, dairy cattle. And define, if you can define a profile and probably select some genes that are important to disease resistance. You get what I mean? And if you find some animals that have these genes that indicate a disease resistance, then we can fast produce offspring to this. And the techniques that will be utilized are not only artificial insemination, but embryo transfer. And that's why I show this cow in the middle. You see that cow in the middle? She was super ovulated, and then they collected off the embryos and did embryo transfer to a lot of other cattle so that those are all her offspring in a matter of a few months, you see, from just a, well, maybe it was only one or two stimulations. I don't know, maybe there's 26 there, huh? It's fantastic. You can imagine how fast you then could produce an animal that would be resistant to a number of diseases. So that's the kind of exciting research that's underway now. And another thing that I got excited about when I was on one of my visits to England, I was up at Cambridge about, I guess, 3-4 years ago, or maybe it was 5. There was a Danish scholar there at Cambridge at their embryo transfer laboratory or embryo transplant laboratory where they did a lot of this work early on. And I thought this would answer a problem for me. What he did was, this is a two-cell embryo, okay? You see the two cells in a sheep. And what he did was to go in and rescue that, and then he separated it off. I won't go through the technique. And out of that two-cell embryo, he made identical twins. See? So you could produce two specimens that were identical. From what one, it started out to be one. And I says, this is an answer to a great problem, because I have all kinds of people, especially older people, that have an animal. And they want, it's getting old, but they'd like to have one just like it. You see, a clone of it. Well, that's sort of impossible. Now you see it isn't, you see. We can bring them a sheep, only we'll do it this way, you see. We'll produce an identical twin. We'll freeze one of them and give them the other one as an animal, see? And it's a little ewe lamb we'll give them. And they're good for quite a few years, 10 or 12 years. All right, when it gets to be 12, then you take the other one, its identical twin, out of the refrigerator or the freezer, and you do a transfer of that embryo into its twin, and she produces her own twin, and then you have a clone, you see? And then you'll have another animal. In fact, I know a sheep that's 18 years old when it died. So you see, they'd have a clone forever. You can take me seriously on this or not, but it really does work as far as that goes. The Canadians have determined that saccharin is dangerous to your rat's health. And a lot of people say, well, all right, so you produced it in a rat. Does that really mean it's true in in people. Well, you have to do it sometimes in more than one species. It is true that rats, especially inbred rats and mice, are, you can, in fact, in mice, you can almost get a shelf item. If you want a mouse that has a incidence of a certain tumor, 50% incidence, 18 months, you can almost buy them as a shelf item. The point here is that you might need multiple studies, and that they may be sensitive. And I couldn't find my other slide, like the one I showed you earlier, where I come into a room. In this particular slide, I'm coming into a room and two of my associates are jumping up and down and shouting hooray and are really happy. And I find out that they've just discovered something that didn't cause cancer. Because it seems like everything we touch causes cancer. But in our work and in my associates, what I try to instill in my students is that you, and this is from, incidentally, from Mail House at Rochester, Minnesota, in the old Mail House on a colored glass window. It was the Mail brothers that said that we must, to cure sometimes, to relieve often, but to comfort always. And that's our assignment. And we must take it seriously. It's been a pleasure for me to bring this to your attention.
And I did finish a little early, intentionally, in case that some of you might have some questions.
I bamboozled you. Well, you can see me afterwards. I'll have you do most of the talking, though, because I still have one more talk before I leave. And that's one of my favorite ones that my wife never attends, my life with the pigs. Pardon?
Since you're
no longer our dean, are you teaching? Yes. I will probably be giving a course this next spring. I'm a visiting professor this fall in the Department of Biomedical History at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and I'm a Battelle Fellow at the Seattle Center. But I'll also be traveling a good deal. I'll be going back to Europe, and I'll be involved with the Human-Animal Bond International Meeting honoring the 80th birthday of Konrad Lorenz in Vienna, and then I'll have meetings in London, in Texas, and Washington, D.C., and California. Well, my Norwegian friends just wrote me and said, can't you come by? It doesn't appear that I'll get up there. I was there last year. Had a great time. In fact, an interesting story on it. I was there on the Friday before the 17th of May. And I mean, it was bedlam, but I was speaking at the university that afternoon. So they had me, had a big press conference in the eighth floor of one of their leading hotels. It was a very good lunch. It was a very good interview. At least two of the leading newspapers were there. And it was a longer press interview than I usually have. And after we finished up, the photographer says, we got to get a picture of you with an animal. Well, this is downtown Oslo, the day before their biggest holiday. I thought it was insane. But I says, all right, we'll go down and see if we can find an animal. Well, one of the correspondents, light on her feet, went running through the traffic. She thought she saw an animal. And she caught up with this lady with his little hound, skinny little hound. And she caught up with her at the bank. And she asked, she told this, I suppose this crazy American was there, and she had to get a picture of him with an animal. Well, and she was all for it. And so she came out, and they introduced me to her. I can't even remember her name now. But she was one of Norway's most famous actresses. In fact, she was playing in a long-run show in town on the life of Edith Piaf. And her dog's name was Piaf. I don't know if you know the story of Edith Piaf. It's a very interesting story. She was a great singer and caught the hearts of the French. And so the next paper in the leading newspaper in Norway was a picture of me and Piaf and telling about the greatness of animals and all. But the story doesn't end this, because the real punchline on this is Pullman isn't very big, but there was another couple from Pullman in Norway at the same time. And they were traveling between Oslo and Bergen. And they were sitting there kind of minding their own business, and they happened to look across. These people had this paper open, and they were looking at it, and here's Busted and this dog. And they says, "We even go to Norway and we can't get away from this crazy guy." All right, it's time. Yes. Yes. The question is, where was I born? Most people think I crawled out from under a rock, but I was born at a very tender age in Snooze Hill, Washington, which is Snooze Hill, Washington. It isn't on the map. It's really east of East Stanwood. And East Stanwood is no longer a town. It's all incorporated with Stanwood now. It's north of Everett and south of Mount Vernon. And it's full of Scandinavians. And my father was born in Norway, and he was in logging, and we had a small farm. Yes. Well, I was raised with animals, and I was very interested in them. I almost went into vocational. I finished out in agriculture and education, vocational agriculture, and then I went off. I was called up from the reserves into the army before Pearl Harbor, and then I went through the African campaigns in Sicily and southern Italy. And I was on the first breakout of Anzio. I got 5 miles. I got further than anybody else. Well, I couldn't hold it. So I ended up in a prison camp for a long time. I was in and out a couple of times. And I had a lot of time to think. One thing about prison camp, you get quite a bit of time to think. Of course, you think a lot about how you're going to get out, if you ever get out, and how you can cross up your captors. So you spend a lot of time with that. But I thought a lot about this, and research had always interested me, either human or medical research. But I was always interested in some healing profession, and I figured out I had already lost over four and a half years, and so I figured that the shortest way to get to research was to go the animal route of veterinary medicine, and I have spent all my time in research until I became a dean in an act of senile dementia. Yes.
Who funds your laboratories?
Oh, yeah. In recent, most of our research monies now come from the National Institutes of Health of the U.S. government. We also have some private money. But we also have some, I think a little bit from NSF. I'm on a small NSF grant now to look at the values and ethics in professional education. U.S. Department of Agriculture also. In fact, on competitive grants, in competitive grant program, our school got 13% of the available funds in the United States this last year. Yes. Well, I'm glad you asked that. I would like to introduce animals in orthopedic homes. I have worked a little bit with the Children's Orthopedic in Seattle. There's a bit of a risk that some of them hesitate to take because of the immunodeficiency that some of them have. I have felt, though, that they can select out the right ones that could greatly benefit them. I think it would shorten their healing time, the therapy time, and the time in the hospital, even if, and this is one of the things I'm going to do when I get to be dictator, is that I'm going to have visible to the children in the children's wards little pigs, little kittens, and little pups playing so they can see them, and maybe little of other species. And I think watching them will probably, lower their anxiety levels. It'll give them something interesting to see. It'll also give them a source of a lot of laughs. I'd throw some goats in there too. In fact, I could almost throw the rest of them away and get some little kids in there. That'd really, really jolly them up. And I think it really would shorten their therapy time. That's a very important area. And in some places they have utilized, like rabbits to and pet. They have used them with mentally disturbed children with very good effect. So more and more we'll be using them as a mode of therapy. Anything else? I think it's time to, that clock, you can't go by it, but it's 5 minutes before Vespers and we have to kind of get things straightened out. Thank you for your interest. And Bev Larson, you wanted the material on the Delta Society. If somebody else wants to look at it, it's got a picture of Bridget in it.